Well, it comes from Daru Unuk, which was translated roughly as the oak plain in the territory of the Uduk. We're a family, a tribe in this area. So going back years ago, this area would have been covered completely by trees, mostly native oak trees.
And we're standing in the square. You probably hear the thunderous traffic going down to Cork and up to Dublin. Are there any oaks here?
No, there's no oaks here in the immediate area. You've got chestnut trees, you've got sycamores, birch tree over there. But the intention would be down the line, we intend planting oak trees to signify the prominence of oak in the area.
The fact that they were so prominent, as you say, all those years ago.
That's right. I mean, there's evidence here of oaks being felled and rafted down the river to Kilkenny. And there was quite a lot of woodland cleared. There was over 650 acres of woodland cleared in the immediate vicinity of the town.
And went down to Kilkenny?
Well, it would have been rafted down the river from here, from the River Erkenna into the River Nore and down to Kilkenny for a lot of the buildings that were down there. So we're certainly well aware of the fact that it is oak that came from this area.
And Anne Lanigan, you have also been involved in developing this loop walk that goes around the edge of Duro.
I suppose about 5 years ago we had the official launch of the leafy loop walks here in Duro, but the work would have been going on that bit longer. So it's just basically a 14-mile stretch of lovely wooded walk. Dunmore is part of it, and we would, I suppose, see it as kind of the jewel in the crown because it's the most popular walk that's used within that loop.
At least it's nice that it's a loop because you can park your car at one end
and pop in and pop out really from a number of different points on it, so it is. It's very accessible.
And that's one of the walks, and the other one is this new one that, Sean, you're involved in, which is the heritage trail, if you like, which is within the town itself.
Yeah, we're planning to develop a local history heritage tour around the village. We'll have about 12 stops incorporating various different important sites around town. For example, the Mill Wheel Project and the Canon Carrigan Memorial Garden.
We're standing right outside St Fintan's Church. And St Fintan would have been quite prominent in the area.
St Fintan would be our earliest documented inhabitant of the town. There was a monastery here founded by him around 600 AD. The monastery existed up until the 1100s or thereabouts. Mm. But at the Protestant church here, it's called St Fintan's Church. There's a very important organ in musical terms. It's one of three by Samuel Green, and it was donated by William Telford to the parish of Duro here.
And used to be in Trinity College?
Yes, it was one of three made by Samuel Green. It was originally in Trinity College, and it was donated by William Telford to the parish.
And you mentioned the mills, and in a minute we'll walk up to a gentleman who remembers the mills and used to work in them, in fact.
Well, one of the points on the Heritage Trail is the mill wheel. We have erected a mill wheel just to commemorate the association of milling in the town. This area along here, along the square, there were originally a number, back in the 1500s, there would have been mills along here, and in fact this place was called Mill Street. A number of years ago we decided that we needed to commemorate the association of the town with milling, so we have developed an area just on the entrance to the town with information plaques relating to the different mills that were situated here in the town.
Taking advantage, of course, of the fact that the River Nore is so nearby and a tributary of the river runs through the village here.
That's right, the River Erkenna. It was harnessed back in the, as I say, the 1500s for power. And that association went on. Then there was a more modern mill built about a mile from the town, close to where the River Erkenna joins the River Nore. And that continued in operation until 1934, when obviously the advance of electricity and power, diesel engines and petrol engines, took over, and the mill no longer was used.
The last mill would have been 1934?
Yeah, it closed in 1934, and yeah. I think the roof was taken off at about the mid-1940s, and eventually it fell into decline.
And this, as the roofs would have been taken off a number of houses around Ireland, and then obviously they didn't have to pay rates.
That's right, yeah, there was a big problem with if the building was roofed, you had to pay rates on it, so a lot of owners took the roof off the building to save having to pay the rates, and unfortunately the buildings fell into disrepair.
Mm. And Anne, do you find, I mean, what kind of people go on these walks, the loop walk, and then obviously in the future there'll be the heritage walk as well? Because, I mean, I know Duro from, shamefully myself, I know Duro from driving through it to Cork. I've never actually stopped here before. I mean, what kind of people will stop and walk?
We find that a lot of the locals would use the walks here, and also throughout the year we would organise things like bat walks, the dawn chorus, environmental themed walks that would bring in people from the surrounding counties, and there would be a great interest in that environmental aspect of our woodland walk here also. And especially with a lot of new residents in the town, I think it's important that, you know, they get this sense of place that we're trying to promote.
And obviously in a couple of years' time you won't get this thunderous traffic anymore because you're being bypassed.
That's true, yes.
Which, yeah, I presume is a good thing, is it?
Well,
I mean, if I lived here, I'd love I'd love the quiet.
You won't have the roar of the passing traffic, but perhaps the businesses in the town might not look on it in such a light, you know, because obviously the passing trade is very important to a lot of the business here, and that's going to be wiped out. So that's, you know, it's going to have a important knock-on effects for those people.
And now we're going to head up to Sean Cashin's house, who's going to tell me a little bit more about the mills here, because he used to work there. But one gentleman who remembers the mills as well is Paddy Ryan.
Paddy, yes, and I'd like to introduce Paddy to you, Ella. He was an old neighbour of mine when I lived here in the town. I live a little bit outside now.
Yeah, and you remember the mills, do you?
Yes, I remember in the 1930s, early 1930s, I remember the mill. And as a young boy then, we used to go down to the mill on a Saturday morning, and we would go up in the loft and push the grain down through a chute where it would be ground. Farmers all around the area, they would have ponies and carts and asses and carts, and they would be parked right from the mill back as far as the bridge in Durrow, half a mile long, waiting to queuing up to get to get our corn
for the services. And how far would the farmers come? How far from around the area would they come?
Oh, well, roughly approximately about maybe 3 miles. Three, 4 miles of a radius.
Too short, is it? It's quite long.
All around the area, they would come with their ponies and carts and asses and carts and bring their corn to the mill. But then you had another mill just about 2 miles from Durrow here called Bailey's Mill. And people in that part of the country would take their corn to Bailey's Mill, which is approximately only about 2.5 miles from Durrow. Mills were, there was quite a few mills in the country at the time operating.
As there were bakeries, because you told me earlier there used to be 5 bakeries in this tiny
little
place.
In Durrow, like, I suppose in them days the population was much greater than it is today. And there were five bakeries in Durrow.
It's a lot of bread.
My family worked in practically every one of those bakeries, baking bread for the people of the parish.
Oh, did they? Do you make your own bread?
Myself, I eat nothing only homemade brown bread.
Do you make it?
And my wife makes
it. Your wife makes it.
Hi, Sean. Hi. Now, this
Hello,
is
Sean, how
Ella,
are you?
Ella McSweeney.
Nice to meet
Sean
you.
Sean Cashin.
Cool.
After bobbling around, I guess. I like to bobble around.
We're after been talking about the mill, Sean.
We just went down to the mill.
We went down to the
mill,
yes.
We saw it. And so you remember when you were younger working there?
I'm just 90 years of age.
90?
90, yeah. I was born in 1917. Well, I won't be 90 until next February. Which was not too far away, sure it was.
No.
Around the corner.
George Evans, he was the foreman in it. He was the miller in it.
And this is the mill as you come into Durrow, just on the left-hand side.
Down the mill road.
Down the mill road.
And just describe it for me. What did it look like?
Oh, quite a fine big buildings. And years gone by, though, I didn't know. They used to make flour in it. And then they give up that and start throwing corn into it. And Guinness used to buy all the corn off Berseers.
Guinness did?
Guinness Brewery. We used to drive to a tan over here, beyond 3 miles, isn't it, Sean?
3 miles, yeah.
And what was your involvement?
I had a horse drawn out of the mill to a tanner.
So you used to come and bring the corn?
To a tanner, for the station over here.
Okay.
A half a crown a load.
Half a crown a load?
Four load in a day.
Busy man.
Busy man, yeah. Oh, the farmers queued up the whole way along the mill.
Yeah, Paddy was saying they were very long queues.
Very long queues, yes, very long queues.
And how long would it take you to get to the train station?
Ah, sure. Nearly an hour to go to Watana and have to load the wagons. come back to him, load up, load him in, he'd go, I'll have another load.
And would many families in the area have been involved in the mills?
Oh, there'd be a lot of families. There was a man who was George Abens, he was the miller, we used to call him. He was the man over the mill, and there was a good few more lads in it.
So a lot of people were employed?
No, employed, yeah. Yes, I was only a young lad, I was only 14, 15 years of age. My father died, we all young. There was 8 of us left in it. 8 of us. And I used to follow the horse.
What was your horse called?
Beg pardon?
What was the horse called?
Charlie.
Charlie. Why'd you call him Charlie?
I don't know.
And was he a good horse? Was he a good horse?
He was a great horse. A great horse.
Yeah, he worked hard.
Worked hard.
There would have been a lot of horses around at that time.
There were all horses. There were no lorries or no nothing at that time. All horses drawn to the corn to the mill, and all the horse farmers drawn down to the mill, you know. All my father's people worked in it, got me good home. There were millers. They lived down there where, Tony Cashin lived, Pad Cashin lived.
Oh, yeah.
There in the house there. They lived down, 3 or 4 of my father's uncles.
They all worked in the mill?
They all worked in the mill. Oh, no, before my time. Before my time. He got a good living, yeah. And then the mill closed down. They were,
Everything. Closing cycles.
Mm. Yeah.
And here I am in Dunmore Wood, just a little bit outside of Durrow. And I've come here to meet with someone who's particularly interested in a little freshwater species that's very special around here. So special that you can't find it anywhere else in the world. And that is the freshwater pearl mussel. This is a particularly unique species. And the person I'm going to speak to is Evelyn Morkins, who specialises in the area. And Evelyn, the species that you find around here, you don't find anywhere else.
No, it's so different that it has it's called after Durrow. It's the only species that's called after the town of Durrow. It's called Margaritifera durrovensis, as this is the only place that it's known from. We have this and one other type of freshwater pearl mussel in Ireland, and the other one is a little more widespread, but both of them are, they're both endangered.
We've come here to the woodland. We're going to start walking in into the woodland, and you're going to get into the water for me. I'm not getting in to see if you can find one, and the chances are pretty low that we're going to find one.
Well, they get fewer and fewer every year. Every year we come back and look for them, and each time there's less of them to see. And it's quite difficult, river to survey, because often it's quite high and highly coloured, so it's hard to spot them, but we'll give it a best shot today.
And the river here, is it particularly clean?
It's not. It used to be. These mussels have been in it for a long time, and we have been able to tell from the shells that we've got out of the river that these mussels were living happily in it until the 1970s. We can age the mussels and see that they reproduced every year. The ones that are living at the moment have reproduced every year from about 1905 to 1973, and since then not one has survived. So it obviously was a lot cleaner back then. Now we're going to climb down this little stretch here down to the river bank. The river's like today.
We can see the river now, just peeking around the corner, and it's quite brown, really, isn't it, the water?
Yes, unfortunately, it seems to stay brown most of the time, and mussels like very clean river to filter in. You know, the brown colour is due to silt or fine sediment that's carried in the water, and that's what makes the mussels clam up, and they don't filter like they should.
No, I've never seen a pearl mussel before, but let's have a look first if we can find one, and then you can show me what it looks like.
Give it a go.
So we're here on the banks of the river, very calm river. It's moving quite slowly.
If the river's low, we'll wade it like this with a viewing bucket that breaks the surface of the water so that you can see what's in the bottom of the water. If the river's high, we have to snorkel it. It can get very deep. It would be just that bit high for snorkeling or for wading, so we'll give it a go today. So I'm just getting into the river. I have a stick just to keep me from falling over. I'm using this bucket, and if you lean over, you can see through it yourself.
You can see to the end.
You can clearly see the bottom of the river, so we certainly don't want to step on one, so this is why I put this in front of me.
Are you looking for any particular feature to find one, or are you just looking in general and see the bed of the river?
Well, the mussels are buried about two-thirds into the bed of the river. They anchor themselves with the foot, their strong muscle. That leaves their siphons to filter up on the open water. So what we're looking for is stable gravel like this, because that's what they like to bury themselves in, to get their foothold in. So I'm looking through the bucket and seeing if there's any telltale signs of these mussels here. When the bit of sunshine comes on the water, it's easy to spot the mussels, because they're filter feeding, and you can see the little filters out. When it shades over, they just look like stones, so they're quite hard to spot.
When you look down as I am now, it's actually very clear.
Yes, it's quite clear at the edges. Yes, it has that brown tinge, which shows that there's suspended solids in it, which is not what the mussels like. So I'll just have to move out for a minute. I'm just working my way up this riffle run here, because that provides more oxygen than the still slow-flowing sections, and that's where they like to be.
Do you tend to survey against the current or with it?
I'd always survey against the current, because then you're not creating silt for yourself, and if you go the other way, then you can't see what you're doing. So you push the bucket down and you just sweep it, and you get a sort of width of about 4 meters that you're able to see. And in good clean conditions, they tend to be all the way across the river, but in poor conditions where you can have a bit of algae, they tend to be closer to the banks.
And it's quite exciting that this is a species only found here. It was named after Durrow. When was it identified?
It was named by a chap called R.A. Phillips, who was a great Irish molluscan scientist, and he described it as a new species new to science, in 1928.
And he found it here in the River Nore?
He found them here, and he found them quite plentiful, and they were plentiful at the time. The unique thing about this population is that it's in very hard water. It's in a lime-loving water, and the rest of the pearl mussels all around Ireland live in acid water. So it's quite unusual, and there's tributaries of the Nore that have acid water, but it's never been found in them, so it's a real enigma. As to why it's here and why it's so different. I can see one now through the bucket.
Oh, really?
If you lean over, you might be able to see it.
Let's see if I can just lean over without falling in.
Fall in. And it's just...
Oh, I can see it.
...in the flow.
And it's exactly like a mussel that you would eat, except much bigger.
Just like the sea mussel. And it's got its foot dug into the water, and it's... If you look carefully, you can see the top of it. It has two siphons, and it's filtering the water away there.
Can we lift it out?
I'll just take it out and show it to you.
So what we have is essentially what looks to me like, the only way I can describe it looks like a kidney.
It's exactly the shape it is, and it's dug in against the flow, and it forms that sort of kidney shape.
It's obviously a hard shell. It's a dark colour with kind of tree rings around it as well.
And the tree rings mark, the rings in it mark the age that it is. And this is quite an aged specimen. Each of those is a year. So that one is probably in its 50s or 60s. It's a relatively young one for the Nore.
And the thing that I was so amazed about pearl mussels, is that they can live up to about 100 years old.
Yeah, some of them live to 120, 140 even. So you're looking at mussels in the river that were born before your grandmother, and it's fascinating. It's probably the oldest animal in Ireland, older than humans.
And it's quite heavy. Does it change colour with time, or is it always that kind of, I don't know how to describe that colour, kind of dark brown colour?
You notice that it's darker at this end.
This is the top.
This is the end that sticks into the open water. So it's got a bit oxidised and it's turned black. And this lighter, browner corner is the bit that's been stuck into the river. So it's stuck there and it's never moved. It's just sat in that same patch of river all its life. So all it's done is sit there and filter the water.
Isn't that just incredible? And it would eat little bits of food that come through the water.
Yeah, it would filter the microalgae and the microbacteria that are in the water, and cleaning it at the same time.
Now, if I had a freshwater pearl mussel that isn't the Durrow species beside me, what would be the difference in terms of what they look like?
It would look slightly bigger for its age, and it would be eroded at this oldest part, because the Nore mussel is in hard water, it doesn't erode, it doesn't get attacked because there's no acid in the water. Whereas, and we're able to age them a lot easier because you can see that's it's a 1 year old ring and you can count the rings much easier. In the rest of Ireland, this would be in acid water, and as it grows at this end, the old at the newest end, it'll be eroding at the oldest end. Yeah, so it's sort of forming new calcium and eroding old calcium. So it is smaller and small, heavy muscle.
It is very heavy, and it's completely closed. And if we could open that, which we won't do, but if we could open it, what would we see?
You'd see the great big foot, very muscular foot, and if we put it back in the water, you'll see it digging its foot in. And this top bit opens as well to allow the siphons to filter the water. And you can see that it's got in such heavy lime that it has a lime deposit on it.
Like muck, isn't it? A bit of muck at the top of it. Like
calcium muck.
Calcium muck. And this is just because the water is full of lime.
It's full of lime and it's depositing on the muscle, yeah.
And how do they reproduce? I mean, how does something like this become another something like this?
Well, most nails are hermaphrodite, but this one isn't. This is divided into males and females, which look identical, but the males produce sperm and the females eggs, and around sort of early June the males release their sperm and out of their siphon, and the females breed them in through their siphon, and the eggs get fertilized, and the females brood these fertilized eggs inside their gills like a little kangaroo, so they're called marsupial brooders. So they will hold these eggs until they develop into tiny baby mussels, and they'll get bigger and bigger until the female can no longer hold them within herself. She can't, you know, sustain them inside her anymore. And she releases them around the end of August, early September, as tiny little bivalves.
How does the male tell the female, I'm about to release all this sperm? I mean, do they have some sort of communication so that they know?
They don't communicate. It's not a very romantic relationship, but it's triggered by temperature. So the female would be ready to accept the sperm because of the temperature, and the male will be able to release them. And they release millions. So it's a real law of averages that if she gets sperm, she'll get millions of them. They could brood about a million of these larvae.
Presumably this little thing, if it's a male, will have released billions of sperm in his time.
Yeah,
because he's, what, 50 years old, you
said? Yeah, and they stay fertile into old age, even the females and the males. So there's always a chance for saving the mussels, because they tend to be fertile into old age.
There's always a chance to save.
It's not very romantic, no. But there's always a chance.
Even when they're 100. The interesting thing as well about the perm mussel here is that they have a kind of parasitic phase on salmon and trout, but isn't actually parasitic.
But it's not parasitic because it's not damaging to the salmon or trout. It can I put this one back now?
Yes, of course.
We won't leave it out of the water too long, so I'll put it back like a phantom. So we'll see him filtering now in a couple of minutes again. Yes, they're only hitching a ride on the salmon or trout, and they do so over the winter, because the first winter they're tiny, they're fractions of a millimetre. So the salmon or trout acts as this temporary host, and they stay on the gills and they grow there, and in return the mussels in the riverbed are filtering the water, making it cleaner.
And what does the salmon get out of it?
Well, they get cleaner water because the mussels are filtering it. So it's more symbiosis than parasitism.
And I suppose it makes sense for the young to be taken away by something, because if everything here stayed here, they'd all be related. I mean, it would be complete inbreeding.
Well, yes, it gives them a chance to roam around as well, because they tend to latch on to salmon or trout that are this year's. They're very young, and then they'll feed and they'll move up or down, and that'll spread the mussels around.
Isn't it amazing? So amazing
it's
life cycle.
It's wonderful, isn't it? They're wonderful. Aren't they beautiful?
They are lovely, and they're very juicy to hold. I mean, they're very kind of weighty, if you like.
Yeah, they're substantial things.
Substantial. Yeah. You know, obviously incredible to realise that, you know, the one that we saw was 50 years old. I mean,
absolutely. What happens after they fall off the salmon or trout is they're still only a tenth of a millimetre, so they have to bury in the sediment. They have to stay completely buried in the sediment for the first 5 years until they're big enough to be able to have that strong muscular foot and hold on. Mm. And then they're able to stick their siphons out and they're able to filter the open water. And that's much cleaner. But if the sediment gets clogged up, they can't get the oxygen and they die. And that's what's happened here. They've reproduced beautifully for the first 70 years of the 20th century and then complete stop. And that's because the conditions just went too bad for them. The future, obviously, we would hope that the river would be cleaned up in the long term. And in the meantime, we're trying to breed them.
In the lab.
This is courtesy of the National Roads Authority that are building a couple of bridges for the new motorway.
Why are they interested in these little things?
Well, they're interested because building bridges can inadvertently release a bit of silt, and another bit of silt could kill some more. So to try and put something back into the river, they are funding a little captive breeding program that's taking place in Ross Cray in the Central Fisheries fish farm there. And there's a wonderful man called Donal Golden who looks after that fish farm. He's a fisheries officer in charge of Ross Cray fish farm, and he's really interested in the mussels, and I'm really excited about that.
So he's breeding them down there.
And then when they're old enough to reproduce, maybe the river will be clean enough for them.
And if you put them a little juvenile now, in a century's time, they could still be there.
Well, that's what I hope to leave behind me.
Lovely legacy.
Hope so.
That programme was first broadcast in July 2006. Shanks Mare was presented and produced by Ella McSweeney. Next week, for the last in the series, Ella goes in search of otters along the Kings River in Kilkenny.